This is Election 2018, the race for New Mexico Attorney General. I'm Fred Martino. In partnership with the League of Women Voters of Greater Las Cruces, we are so pleased to present this forum today. We have invited the candidates for Attorney General to join us for the forum. They will have 90 seconds to respond to each question and should not mention their opponent in the answer. The candidates who responded to our invitation are Republican Michael Hendricks and Libertarian Blair Dunn. Thanks to both of you for participating. Thank you so much.
Thank you.
Thank you as well to Kim Sorensen. She is the president of the League of Women Voters of Greater Las Cruces, and she has our first question.
Thank you, Fred. It's a pleasure to be here. The first question goes to Mr. Hendricks. How would you, as Attorney General, educate the public about relevant issues?
I think there are many ways to educate the voters. I think mass media is obviously one of those. But I think you can't diminish what it means for an elected official who's supposed to be a servant of the people to go to the people in different areas. And not just going to the major metropolitan areas either, because New Mexico is mainly rural. So I think making sure that we're moving the conversation into areas that could be just as affected, if not more, in rural areas. For instance, Albuquerque has one of the highest crime rates in the country. But if you look across New Mexico on a per capita basis, there are about three cities that actually have higher per capita crime than Albuquerque. But yet, when we talk about crime, many times Albuquerque is where it starts and stops. And so making sure that we're not disincluding whole groups of people just because they don't have the same vote number in their area. So mass media going to, and also creating educational formats where we can help people be able to access the information online, which would require that people have access to online media and platforms. So making sure some of those things are being pushed forward so that that information is readily accessible no matter where you live.
Okay, thank you. Mr. Dunn?
Well, it's an interesting issue, especially for the Attorney General's office. The Attorney General's office is, of course, the officer charged with enforcing public records laws and making sure the public is informed about what all of government is doing. One of the major reasons that I decided to run is that I have a big focus for my practice has been making sure that the public has access to information. That means making sure that access to those public records for any agency should be the rule and allowing the public the greatest amount of information. One of the major focuses of my office as Attorney General would be to make sure that transparency increases and the public is informed anytime they want to know what any portion of their government is doing. That includes the Attorney General's office, which needs to be the shining example of transparency and accountability for all of state government, and to make sure that the public has access to all of that information that any different agency might have. I'm certainly a very big fan of making sure that the public is aware through social media and through mass media with information about what's going on in the Attorney General's office. But I really do truly believe that if anybody wants to know what's going on in the Attorney General's office, the client for the state of New Mexico is the people, or for the Attorney General is the people of New Mexico. And you absolutely have a right to know what your attorney is up to.
Thank you.
Okay, Mr. Dunn, we'll begin with you on this one. How would you effectively advocate for consumers?
You know, I will say that one of the major things that I would say that has been done well in past administrations for the Attorney General's office is to advocate on behalf of consumers. That said, I'm not sure that the consumers really understand what the Attorney General's office has to offer as far as those resources. And this goes to your last question and making that information more readily available so that people understand if they do have a consumer protection issue, that they know who to go and who to get in touch with, and make it easier to access the Attorney General's office and to talk to somebody, a real person on the other side of the line. All too often, we have complaints about telemarketers calling, but the same token, when we turn around and we call the Attorney General's office to report somebody doing something improper in that forum, you end up with a recording, and you may not get the person on the other end of the line to actually talk to and tell your problem to. So one of the things that I'm a big proponent of is making sure that when somebody calls your government, somebody's on the other end of the line.
Okay. Mr. Hendricks.
So I see it very similarly. My biggest issue, and I think the reason there have been issues in the past, is generally because constituents don't donate a lot of money. They don't have the money businesses have. So what I would focus on is making sure that people are held accountable, the businesses are held accountable in the way that they should, despite what they may donate to a campaign. I've been very careful to not take donations where I think pressure, undue pressure, would exist, simply because I want to make sure that people know that I work for them. I don't work for big business in New Mexico. I work for the people of New Mexico. I want to work for the people of New Mexico to make sure that their considerations are not only known and heard, like Mr. Dunn was talking about, but also that they're acted upon in a solicitous manner, not leaving a big gap between when somebody calls you for an issue with the AG's office and when action is actually taken. We've seen many times, not talking about any particular administration, but many times where around the country, those actions are not done quickly enough. People lose faith in the institution when their complaint seems to be heard but not acted upon. So we'd want to act upon them quickly.
Okay. Mr. Hendricks, how would you help prevent consumer scams, especially phone scams?
Once again, that goes back to a similar answer to the very first question. I mean, I think notifying the constituents, notifying people, I don't like calling people constituents because they're not an item, they're a person. Notifying the people that you represent in this state that there is something that is going on. Now, in New Mexico, once again, that's difficult sometimes. Mass media, a lot of people don't watch television, even if they have television. They don't have cable. They're not on the broad networks. And then we have an issue where there is internet absent throughout this whole state. So once again, in my practice, I'm an immigration attorney going all over the state, and what I've done is I've actually taken the practice to the people. So I go to the rural areas, places where there aren't any attorneys to service the population. And go ahead and take the service to them rather than having them come to me. And I think as the Attorney General, that would be one of the main things I would focus on, is taking the services to the people. What I call them is mobile consultations. And I think that should be done. Going to the people in their area where they have need and addressing them directly, and not trying to just hope that they're seeing the alerts on mass media, but taking it to the people and even local forums. Putting it in the public forums where people can have the papers up on these bulletin boards that people see all the time in the Navajo Nation and other locations like that, as well as other rural areas.
Okay, thank you, Mr. Dunn.
In a similar fashion, one of the things that I've seen the Attorney General's office do in the past that I think is a good one is they go to places where there are large groups of people. For instance, the State Fair, they generally have a booth, and a large focus of the booth is consumer protection, and they oftentimes have quite a bit of information about current causes for concern or scam alerts, those types of things. I think that's absolutely something you need to do, but it also gets back to being able to interact with the local communities by having meetings. As Mr. Hendricks mentioned, I agree with that. Being out and having those listening sessions, and then also providing information to the public through the smaller newspapers. And one of the things that I would credit Mr. Hendricks for is being able to reach across language barriers, which we do have the issue of in this state, and making sure that it's available to people in multiple languages, not just Spanish and English, but also having it in Navajo if need be, or whatever it might be, especially if it's something that's affecting those populations of people that really do need to have some explanation that's easily noticed by them, not something in a language that may not be their first language to them.
Okay. Mr. Dunn, what is the Attorney General's role in fighting the opioid crisis in New Mexico?
Well, this gets to a big part of my platform. And one of the big things that I think we are going to have to deal with in this country, and by and large, certainly here in New Mexico, is legalization of marijuana in order to deal with that problem. That's a big issue that my campaign has been focused on. I'm a big proponent of the medical cannabis community, and helping to make sure that those patients are taken care of, and making sure that we do those types of things that make that a treatment that's available for more people. I think plenty of studies have now shown that when it comes to treating the opioid crisis, one of the major silver bullets for that is going to be making other pain medications or other avenues for treatment available, one of which is cannabis. And we're seeing very good results for that with people in the cannabis industry, in the medical cannabis industry. So we absolutely need to be making sure that those protections for the medical cannabis community are in place, so that that is a treatment that is more easily obtained for people in order to start addressing that. And then on top of that, it's again getting to working with federal authorities to come up with joint task force in order to be able to address those types of situations that are an endemic problem for the whole country, not just for New Mexico.
Okay. Mr. Hendricks.
I guess my approach would be a little bit different. I would rather see more facilities that are opened in order to help those who are already suffering from addiction. My wife is a licensed mental health counselor. And one of the things that we've noticed is that despite our desire on the face of it to take care of the opioid crisis, there is very little being done in the form of addiction relief. A lot of the facilities that we have closed down. When officers take people off the street because of some criminal activity that is related to opioid usage, they're having a hard time getting them into facilities. And I certainly believe that people need to pay for their crime. So if they commit a criminal act, that's something they should pay for. But at the same time, we have to address the root causes. And right now, it appears that we're not addressing the root causes of the opioid crisis, which can be up into including doctors over-prescribing medications. And I've seen lately that we've started doing the take-backs again. That's a very good use of Attorney General resource and time in order to get those medications out of people's medicine cabinets so that children don't start to get a hold of those. But I think the facilities that help people overcome the actual addiction is going to be the best way to get them off that road. And secondly, a program that I've been working with Congressman Pierce on is actually getting people into jobs, taking them out of their situation, getting them a job so that they can get out of that lifestyle.
Okay, the next question goes to you, Mr. Hendricks. What is the Attorney General's role in protecting the public's access to information?
I think it's a vital role. I don't think that you can have a protector. I see this way. The Attorney General's office, if you put it in business terms, because that's what I am, I'm a businessman. When you put it in business terms, the Attorney General's office is a business with 250 employees that is in the business or sells the product of protecting people, the people of the state, and protecting the state from bad actors. In order to do that, you work for the people. These are your people. You're a servant. How can a servant do his job, his or her job, without anyone that he's supposed to be serving knowing anything that's going on? That's one of my biggest issues with what's been happening in the past, is the state is replete with a lot of dark, shrouded clouds to where, yeah, this is my government, but then you ask, what's your government doing? And nobody has the answer because that information isn't readily available. I would create there's a sunshine portal, but I want to create almost a Google synonymous for us to be able to allow people to request clearances. Once they have a certain clearance, then at that point, they'll be able to Google, and getting this information onto a server to where it can be Googled, that's gonna be the time consuming part. But once it's there, people will be able to access it just by putting in the information, getting access to what they have clearance to get access to. So that would be my response, and it's very important.
Okay. Thank you, Mr. Dunn.
So open records, as I've already discussed, is a passion for me. From the start of my law practice, that has been one of the things that I've worked on consistently and worked on, and the highlight of my legal career thus far has been winning the Dixon Award from the Foundation for Open Government last year. Absolutely, the Attorney General's office is supposed to be the chief enforcer of our transparency laws. That means that they're supposed to set the example, they should be the most transparent themselves, and more importantly, they're supposed to be the one that holds the rest of the government accountable to make sure that those records are available to the public like they should be. Transparency is supposed to be the rule, secrecy is supposed to be the exception. We haven't always seen that to be the case in New Mexico government, and we absolutely need somebody that will stand up and do that. To that end, I have clients and I've worked with people that couldn't readily figure out how to make a complaint to the AG's office when a local government or another state agency is not being transparent. I think having some sort of hotline available to the public so that they can call and make a report if there's somebody that is not being transparent, or just get advice on how to go about requesting records, is absolutely something the Attorney General's office should be doing as the chief enforcer of public records law in New Mexico.
Okay. Mr. Dunn, would you use your office, if elected, to support efforts to reform the criminal justice system? Explain.
I would, absolutely. And this goes to now another one of the questions that we've had, which was dealing with the opioid crisis. I think that when it comes to criminal justice reform, one of the things we have to again, look at as a country is that the number one leading offense, arrest offense, and the number one reason for people to be incarcerated at this point is for some sort of drug-related offense. We have a whole lot of people sitting in prisons that are there for no other reason than they ingested or smoked something or did something to themselves that hurt no one but themselves. And we as a society have to look at those types of things and say, is that really something that should be a criminal activity when you take and you do something that doesn't have a victim and you make that person a criminal for a victimless crime? I really think that if we want to address the prison populations, we're going to have to look at decriminalizing a lot of what we consider criminal offenses for nonviolent offenses. Certainly property theft and violent crimes, people should have to pay for that, and they do pose a danger and a threat to society. But if we really want to start to deal with criminal justice reform, we need to be looking at decriminalizing those types of offenses. Texas has a very good model that they've gone to, and that is once you have somebody incarcerated, there's another thing that you have to deal with, which is what are you gonna do with that person when they do come out of the prison system? And they have what they call right to crime. They've passed that in Texas. Deals with rehabilitation. I think that's another big issue. If we're going to have right now our criminal justice system acting as the mental health hospitals, we're also going to have to address mental health in terms of what we do with people when they go into the prison system.
Okay, Mr. Hendricks.
And I agree in part with some of that, especially the rehabilitation process, getting people out of the situation. Generally, people fall into the same activities that they've done before because they're surrounded by the same actors. You have somebody go in and many times they actually come out worse. There's no rehabilitation. The point of prison is not just to punish. It's not just retribution, it's also rehabilitation. It's supposed to help people to come out on the other side as better citizens, people that can be active in society, that can contribute to society in a meaningful way. And what we're seeing is that's not the case. The number one mental health facility in the state, across the state, are the various county jails. They're not specifically equipped for that, and that's not their vocation, that's not their goal. We have to have systems and processes in place that help these folks after they've gone through the system. But it also goes back to the education part, because we were talking about how do we want to educate people about certain things across the state. Educating parents on what the symptoms of a child that's at risk for using drugs. What are the symptoms and what are the actions that they can see to show them that their child may be at risk for dropping out of high school? What are the different things that parents can do affirmatively without it having to be a subsequent attack on a criminal activity, but rather an affirmative action that can help people address the issues before they become criminal activities?
Okay. Mr. Hendricks, what practices do you advocate to make the justice system fairer for the poor?
Well, one of the biggest things that I have an issue with is the current interpretations of the amendment, the constitutional amendment that allowed everyone to be released on bond and so on and so forth. They didn't have financial wherewithal. And the biggest problem with that is partially because of the lack of the staying with continuity with the amendment as it's written. But the low income have to have access to justice. And we're not talking about just at the backside when they've already committed a crime and now, or allegedly committed a crime and are now looking to get out on bail. But we're also talking about those who need criminal justice access when they are trying to get some type of an affirmative thing. So in immigration, one of the things we look at is we have in our office, we do literally hundreds of hours of pro bono work. And that's when we find clients who genuinely cannot afford whatever it is that they need, but yet this would help them and help them to move forward in their life, then we provide those services. And I think that having access to that kind of thing is very necessary. Albeit I'm not sure that it is exactly a government function, but I do believe it is very necessary. And having a group of people who can provide that function, I think, would be a very positive outcome for those in need.
Okay, thanks. Mr. Dunn?
So one of the things that was just discussed is, of course, the bail reform issue. And some of the impacts, the disparate impacts to indigent and to people of different race, and the impacts that they have and the incarceration rates that go with that. And certainly when you look at bail reform, there's been a movement in this country to do something to fix that problem so that it's not disproportionately affecting those without financial means. Now, we have the benefit in New Mexico of having made a great decision in 2016 to pass an amendment to our New Mexico Constitution that allowed for those without financial means to be able to access that presumption of innocence that we all have when we're accused of committing a crime. The issue has been, since that time, this New Mexico Supreme Court decided that that reform that the voters overwhelmingly supported did not go far enough. And so they took it one step further and put a reform into place through legislating from the bench that allows for everybody to be released without any sort of bail or surety. That has caused a problem. It's put everybody on a playing field where everybody is released, and it got away from what we were trying to do, which was to make it so that those without financial means could access what we already have in the legal community as far as a way to obtain representation or to obtain that presumption of innocence. That was in the Constitution amendment. It was supposed to be filing a motion. We decided not to go that route, or the Supreme Court decided not to go that route, and so now we have another system in place. But I think New Mexico is on the forefront of figuring out how to help deal with our indigent population and making sure that they can get out, obtain that presumption of innocence, and obtain representation from a public defender's office.
Okay. Mr. Dunn, what practices do you advocate to deal with mental health problems in those who have been arrested and incarcerated?
Well, I think this gets to the point on many of these questions. We don't treat mental health in this state anymore. Right now, we incarcerate people with mental health issues, and that's just simply not what a caring and humane society should be doing to address that issue. Unfortunately, I think a lot of this is going to come back to the next governor and to the legislatures to come to figure out how we address that as a population. But it again gets to my point, is that incarcerating somebody with an addiction problem, which is a mental illness problem, and making them go sit in a prison and expect that they're going to come out and do anything except return back to that addiction is never going to happen. So we have to have those criminal justice things in place to where we're treating addictions and we're treating mental health rather than trying to incarcerate people. And addressing, like I said, things like legalizing certain crimes or the use of certain substances is something we're going to have to address, because you're not going to address people that are addicted to a substance by just increasing the penalties. When it comes to what we've done with DWIs, I think it's clear in the state that we don't have a DWI problem, we have an alcohol problem in the state, and we don't address that. We really need to start looking at addressing the things that lead to alcoholism, that lead to people to get behind the wheel 6, 7, 8, 9 times, even whether or not they have a license, because it's not increasing the penalties. It needs to be treating the underlying diseases.
Okay. Mr. Hendricks.
So this is something that goes back to a big part of my platform, is addressing the root causes of things. I do believe, and I'm a firm believer, and I will say it time and time again, that people have to be punished for their criminal activity. But that cannot be where we stop. We must begin to address the problem once it has surfaced by getting folks help in a mental health facility that is run in a location that is conducive to getting better. Once the criminal activity has been punished, then at that point, putting these people into a facility, not extending their time, but maybe truncating the amount that they're actually in prison and then increasing the amount that they stay in a location like a mental health facility, where they can obtain the help that in a environment that is conducive to actually getting better. Because without addressing that, we're not really addressing the root causes of them, but also we're not addressing the root cause at a very young age, because in New Mexico, we have a very young age as the threshold where people start using narcotics and start drinking. So we have to begin addressing it at a very young age through an educational process with parents and with students, in order to let them know, here are the harms. Remember the fried egg in the pan, right? This is your brain on drugs. It kind of that, but hopefully a little more informative and a little less hyperbolous, but nevertheless, accessing them where they are before they start the process. That way, truncating the problem for the future.
Thank you. Okay, Mr. Hendricks, what practices do you advocate to lessen recidivism in those who are released from prison on parole or after serving their sentences?
Well, one of the main things that I'm looking at is a work program, getting people into jobs. What happens is a lot of times people come out of jail or prison, depending on where they're at, and they're unable to access quality work. I don't know how many of the people out there watching have ever worked on a farm. We're in Las Cruces, so probably a fair number. But I'll tell you, I worked on a farm for many years. I milked cows by hand, picked corn, planted alfalfa, grew it, reaped it. I always want to translate that into Spanish because generally I say that in Spanish. And it is the hardest work you'll do, but it is also the most rewarding. And I think giving people a sense of that reward at the end of a tough day that doesn't include a tough day of running away from the police later, then I think if we can give them that sense of honor, that sense of self-respect, I believe people will stop returning to the same well of crime and will start going to the well of good citizenship. That is my belief, and I believe that we can do that by helping people get out of their situation they were in before and having maybe a work program in place where they get paid, they get housed, but it allows them to get away from those negative influences and into a place where they can start to heal maybe the wounds that they have by seeing that hard work a lot of times pays off, and it's very rewarding.
Okay, thank you. Mr. Dunn?
So what we're talking about is a problem where people are institutionalized. And they go into the system, and what we're doing is they're going in for something, and they're ultimately becoming criminals that come out and perhaps commit more crimes. Part of the reason why they do that is because, and I've mentioned the right on crime issue from Texas, the legislation they passed there, is that they don't obtain anything that rehabilitates them while they're in the prison system. So like Mr. Hendricks just said, discussing ways so that when they're in the prison system that they're gaining some skill sets, that they're learning the joy of good hard work and making things better and producing something. Those are all very good things. We absolutely have to start looking at reforming the prison system so that when people come out, they can. The other thing, and this is probably something that's outside of the purview of the Attorney General's office, but we as a state need to start looking at incentivizing employers that after somebody goes through some sort of a certification in the prison system, when they come out, that those employers will hire them. Because we can let them work all that we want to in the prison system, but if they get out and nobody will hire them, they're going to turn right back to crime, no matter how much they may have learned in prison. If we don't have some way of incentivizing employers to pick these people up and hire them, we're trapping them in a system. The other thing, as I've mentioned, we need to stop sending as many people to prison for crimes that just really are not appropriate to send them to prison for.
Okay, Mr. Dunn. What is your position on the status of medical marijuana in the state and on the legalization of recreational marijuana?
I'm fairly certain I've covered that one, but at this point I'll say it again. I'm a big proponent of the medical cannabis community and that the work that they're doing to provide, an alternative for pain relief to people, what they're doing as far as some very breakthrough things and how they're treating other types of things like we discussed with the opioid crisis. I'm a big proponent of not only keeping that where it is from the medical cannabis standpoint, but also improving the protections so that if we do go the route of legalization for recreation, which I am in favor of, we don't swamp our system with that we very much need for patients in the medical cannabis, that they have protections in place so that they don't get overrun by what we've seen in Colorado, which is the recreational side of that industry taking over and making it hard for people that need that medication and need it as a medication to not be able to obtain it. So that's one of those things I hope the Attorney General's office would weigh heavily in, getting it decriminalized, taken off the schedule at a federal level. But then when we do it here in New Mexico, work on policies that make sure that we provide protection so that the patients can access the products while allowing for responsible use. The other thing that we're going to have to talk and deal with when we talk about legalizing for recreation is we don't need kids. There's plenty of studies that show that young adults under the age of 21 consuming cannabis can have some major serious mental issues from doing that. So we've got to be careful that we have those types of safeguards in place and that people aren't driving or impaired under the influence. But that gets to the point. If you're using something, you absolutely shouldn't be doing it in a way that puts somebody else at risk.
Mr. Hendricks.
So my take is a little bit different. For the medical marijuana side of it, in New Mexico, when the Attorney General takes office, he takes an oath. And that oath is to uphold the laws of the state, but also to uphold the laws of the federal constitution. So when you have a law in your state that is at odds with the federal system, then you have to begin to weigh to see which one you're having to enforce. In this case, because the federal system basically by default has all but, I mean, they never went after the states that are doing it. Therefore, in my opinion, that means I would say medical marijuana, no problem. On the other side, for recreational, I believe that the federal government, based on the constitutional law that they have, should never be telling a person they cannot do something because they may eventually commit a crime with it. That is a preemptive criminalization. And I just don't think that that's within the purview of the federal government. However, in response to that as well, the Attorney General of New Mexico has nothing to do with that. And so I would say to those watching and listening, if you want that to change at the federal level, change your legislators, because they're the ones that have to go and look at the Schedule I for the federal system and the Controlled Substance Act, and they would be the ones to have to change that. The AG cannot do that. But as far as recreational, I don't believe the federal government should be preemptively criminalizing. And for medical, they've just defaulted to whatever the state says.
Thank you. So, Mr. Hendricks, discuss your position on New Mexico's relationship to the federal government in immigration enforcement.
Okay, this is a very interesting question. So, immigration is a preempted federal law. In other words, because the border of a state may border along another country, the border is nevertheless the border of the federal system. So when you border another country, no one ever says, I'm going to immigrate to New Mexico. They would say, I'm going to immigrate to the United States. As such, the immigration process is under federal purview. However, in New Mexico, we do have border violence. We have the Border Violence Task Force, where we can look at what's going on at the border. We can work with those who are across the border. And como yo hablo español, yo puedo trabajar con esa gente sin cualquier problema. So since I speak Spanish, I can work with all those neighboring locations without any problem. And I actually do work with them. I was the consulting attorney for the Mexican consulate for the whole state of New Mexico. And working on those systems together in tandem will allow us to address problems that actually can increase crime here. For instance, many of the cars that are stolen here end up in Mexico. Being able to address those, maybe it's not immigration per se, like people immigrating, but it nevertheless falls inside the immigration system through Border Patrol, through ICE. So working in tandem with the federal agencies to make sure that we're quelling any of the issues that arise from people randomly coming across the border or moving traffic across the border.
Thank you. Mr. Dunn.
So Mr. Hendricks and I rode down today, and I promised him that I wouldn't say ditto if he didn't say ditto, and I'm not going to say ditto. But he's certainly correct when it gets down to the point that federal immigration is a federal issue. It's not a state issue. There's not a lot that the New Mexico Attorney General is going to be able to do to access that on a federal level. Now, if the federal government does decide to respect that the states may be a better place to address issues of border security, which I think is what you're seeing with the joint task force that he just mentioned, I think absolutely the Attorney General has to look at dealing with those crimes that are crossing the border and work on it from a New Mexico perspective. And I believe that regardless of which of the two of us you do, one of us may speak Spanish than the other, but I think that we would both address that in a similar vein. So,
okay. Mr. Dunn, this is a two-part question, and I will repeat this question for you, Mr. Hendricks, when we get to that point. The first question is general. What policies do you advocate to ensure that law enforcement is accountable for the actions of its officers? The second one, specific, should police departments be accountable to civilian boards? Explain.
Well, if you'd let me, I'd like to take the second one first,
sure.
Because that's an easy answer. And yes, absolutely, civilian oversight and participation in your police is absolutely something that we need. Just like any other portion of government, absolutely the citizens should be involved, and an oversight board is a great way to provide a community perspective to a police force. When it comes to accountability for the police force, there's two things that I'd like to discuss. The first is qualified immunity, and that's a major issue that we've run into. I'm a civil rights attorney. I do quite a bit of that. We deal with cases where people's Fourth and 14th Amendment rights have been violated, oftentimes by the police force. And because of what's happened through a judicially created doctrine called qualified immunity, there's almost no accountability through the court system. We have the Civil Rights Act, which is 42 USC 1983. That provides that a citizen that has their constitutional rights trampled can sue a state actor for violating those constitutional rights. That's how we hold the police accountable for excessive force or for illegal search and seizure. That's been all but eviscerated. And I think that an attorney general needs to be standing up in the court system and saying, absolutely, when people's civil rights are trampled, even the police need to be held accountable. And that hasn't happened. Bearing in mind I don't have a whole lot of time, I'd stress that that is the major way that we hold the police accountable, is that we provide, that federal law provides a avenue where we can do that. And we need to restore that protection from that federal law.
Okay, Mr. Hendricks, that two-part question, the policies that you advocate to ensure that law enforcement is accountable for the actions of its officers. Second part of the question, should police departments be accountable to civilian boards?
And I'm going to take the second one as well first, and 100% yes. The fact is that police departments have become quasi-militaristic. And although we need folks that are going to stand up, and I am blue through and through, but at the same time, these are people. And many people use power for their own means. And without the oversight from the people that you're supposed to be protecting, then I think you have an unchecked command system. Because the ones that should be responsible are the police, and they're responsible to the people to protect and to serve the people. And so returning to, I believe that oversight from the civilian board is very important. I believe that having openings for when there are excessive force claims and constitutional violations are important as well. And I 100% agree that having qualified immunity, which basically has become absolute immunity, is a real problem. Because then you're basically saying that a person that has a badge on, and once again, I am for law enforcement. I will stand up for them day and night. But a badge does not make you infallible. And when we allow people to do things, when we allow even officers to do things without a lot of checks and balances, then that tells them they're infallible. And we can't have that. We have to have people who understand their place in society, which is a servant of society. And that's how I think we do that.
Thank you. Mr. Hendricks, what do you advocate should be done to improve public safety, especially in our schools?
So public safety in general, I have a plan that has come out talking about the connection between the Attorney General and local law enforcement. So one of the things I ask a lot of folks is, where's the Attorney General's jurisdiction? Well, in the city, you have the chief of police, the county, you have the sheriff, tribal, you have the tribal police and whoever's the top of that. State police, you have the chiefs there, but the governor at the end is there. So where are anything in between? That's all the connective tissue. There's no real jurisdiction that is solely to the attorney general. So the way I always describe it is the attorney general is the cavalry. The attorney general has the resources and ability and a lot of times the expertise that local law enforcement doesn't have in order to go in and support local law enforcement, to bolster local law enforcement, to help them to be able to do their job. For instance, there's a task force that doesn't include the attorney general at this time, but the task force right here up in Albuquerque, specifically for car thefts. And it is between the sheriffs, the state police, and Albuquerque Police Department. It has worked well. The first quarter of this last year, we saw auto thefts go down for the first time in a long time. Why? Because there was a coordinated effort. That would be bolstered and increased with the attorney general being part of those groups. Another one, the Taos compound. There were a lot of groups of people listed, in law enforcement groups listed that went into that compound to help break that up, and the attorney general wasn't one of them. Having the office do what it is meant to do, and I think that is how we lower crime.
Okay, thank you. Mr. Dunn?
So one of the important things that the Attorney General does is he sits on the Law Enforcement Academy Board. And that's the avenue by which you could go about figuring out a good way to place more officers that are trained to deal with school-type situations into our schools to increase safety. I do think that an increased presence of law enforcement officers that are strictly there for protection of the students is the way to go when it comes to dealing with school safety. But the way to obtain that and to make sure that they're properly trained is through the Law Enforcement Academy Board. There are some major issues right now with the different law enforcement academies and what we have for the criteria by which we're training our officers. But I think that's absolutely something that the Attorney General could go in and say, as the, I believe it's the ex officio president of that board, to say, we need a curriculum here so that we can train people to be law enforcement officers in our schools to provide those that safety for our students. That's an absolute thing the Attorney General should be doing right now at this time.
Okay. Mr. Dunn, is cybersecurity an issue in New Mexico? Explain.
Well, as somebody that's had their identity hacked, I think it is. I would say that it's absolutely something that, again, this gets back to the awareness and the things that the Attorney General's office can do, working as part of a team with the federal, on the federal side of things, to go after that, working with the FBI and a federal task force to go after and address cybersecurity. I think it's a major problem for this country in general. And I don't say that just because my identity was stolen, but I do think that you hear lots and lots of horror stories. And there's not a lot being done to combat that. There's not a lot of education, but there's also not a lot of enforcement of those types of crimes and going after people that would do that. And that's absolutely somebody harming somebody else. And it may need that we need, maybe that we need a change in the legislature. As Attorney General, I'd absolutely advocate for strengthening some of those laws here in New Mexico so that we can go after and devote some of the resources of the Attorney General's office to going after individuals that would commit those types of crimes against individuals here.
Okay. Mr. Hendricks.
I think it's a little more complex. I do believe that laws have to do with how deterrent or how much of a deterrent is placed on people that would do this. The problem is a lot of these folks are outside of our jurisdiction. A lot of cybersecurity threats don't come from people here locally. A lot of them come from Central African countries, from Eastern European countries. And so there's a lot more that has to be done rather than just deterring, because you can't deter people that you can't get a hold of. But what I will say is there are plenty of private companies who are very good at making sure that they can help protect your identity, help protect your information that's on your computers and other things that are maybe in the cloud and so on and so forth. I think tapping into those resources, I don't know that any one state, especially a state the size of New Mexico, is going to be able to get those professionals to the level that would be needed in order to provide a good security. So maybe even coordinating at a state level with private organizations that can provide that type of security that people are able to tap into and access. And I don't mean blanket provision. I'm talking about enforcement provisions. Once maybe something has happened, then at that point being able to work with the local law enforcement to go after whoever it is and making sure that the FBI or Interpol or other people and groups are made aware and also part of the system in order to bring that to justice.
Okay, Mr. Hendricks, are New Mexico's environmental laws adequate and properly enforced? What would you advocate to improve the laws and their enforcement?
So the environmental system that we have here, of course, we have a lot of natural resources. New Mexico is replete with natural resources that can be used for great good, but that also allows people to use the land and other features in a way that can be detrimental. There's no doubt about it. What we don't want to see is that a group of people become so worked up about obtaining a gain that then they diminish the maybe pristineness of our state. I do believe that the laws that are on the books are sufficient. I do believe that there's been a little bit of enforcement on those that is a little politically motivated, and so I would be very careful not to allow that to happen, while at the same time holding people to a standard that says, yes, while you may be accessing something that is accessible, we want to make sure that that's done in a good way, a way that is not damaging for permanency, the land that maybe you're having to use in order to get to that mineral. So that's my response.
Mr. Dunn?
I disagree just a little bit as far as whether or not the enforcement of those laws has been adequate at this point. I think that, as Mr. Hendricks points out, that responsible use of our resources is absolutely something we should do. Teddy Roosevelt said that conservation means development as much as it does protection. But that means that you have to take care of it. And there are going to be those that no matter what laws you have on the books, won't follow them. And I don't believe that we've done enough at this point to enforce those laws against people that would pollute or harm the environment. And I believe that if we enforce the laws that we have on the books, which I do believe are by and large adequate to address most of what we have to take care of our resources in New Mexico, has been done to the level that it should. So I would absolutely take a look at working with good actors, people that are engaged in conservation in a proactive manner, to figure out best practices that work for them, and then to find those people that don't take care of our environment and make sure that they're held to account under the laws that we have. And I do believe that there's been an amount of lackadaisical approach to dealing with some of those bad actors. Some of it may absolutely be a political game that's being played, but we have the laws, everybody should follow them. And if you're going to do something that would hurt the environment, you need to understand you're doing something that hurts your neighbor, and you shouldn't be allowed to do that without consequence.
Thank you.
Okay. Mr. Dunn, how will you maintain transparency and accountability in the Attorney General's office?
So one of the big things that I've had to deal with in recent history dealing with the Attorney General's office is the idea of attorney-client privilege as it comes to the Attorney General's office. And this gets to a major point. One of the things that I've worked on recent lawsuits is who is the client for the Attorney General's office? I talked a little bit about this. Absolutely, the client for the Attorney General is the state of New Mexico. And who is the state of New Mexico? It's people. So there are only a very, very small amount of instances where something should not be readily accessible to the public. And the transparency of the Attorney General's office should be the most transparent of any agency because we are the attorney for the state. There are certainly those instances in criminal prosecutions where we don't want to broadcast the strategy. There may be instances, for instance, in the tobacco litigation where we don't want to broadcast litigation strategy. But on everything else, especially policy issues that the Attorney General's office is involved in, it should be readily available, it should be completely transparent, and I would put it up on whatever Sunshine portal or website we could possibly have and make sure that people, if they want to know what's going on, they can go get those records as easy as we can possibly make it for them to get to them. You shouldn't have to go through jumping through hoops, pinpointing exactly what the record is you're looking for before the Attorney General's office turns over a record to you, and only to have them turn around and say, well, that's attorney-client privileged and we're not going to share it with you. That should be very rare that people ever hear this is attorney-client privileged and we're not going to share it with you, the public, our client.
Okay, Mr. Hendricks.
I agree, and I think I addressed this partially earlier. I would want to create a system by which people could basically search and find documents that are readily available, and I think most documents should be readily available. And I do think, as Mr. Dunn said, that this should be a process that happens very quickly. People shouldn't have to wait months in order to get records. I deal with the FOIA system, the Freedom of Information Act system, across the federal system in various different agencies. And a lot of times I have to wait 6 months or more to get my documents back. I would say that type of slowed access is almost no access, because whatever I needed them for very well might be dissipated by the time I get them. So making sure that this is something that we react to quickly, making sure the information for the Attorney General's office, the Attorney General shouldn't have anything to hide. The office is for the people, it's for the protection of the people, and I don't understand why things could be happening that may need to be hidden. And so making sure that it is open and available keeps not only the people happy because they want to see, but it also keeps an accountability in the office that may not otherwise exist if you have the opportunity to abscond. So we want to make sure that opportunity doesn't exist, and make sure that we're all following the rules and have those in place so that people can have a check on us, the ultimate check, the people.
Thank you. Okay, Mr. Hendricks, discuss one other issue not yet mentioned which requires the attention of the Attorney General in New Mexico. How would you address it?
I think one of the biggest ones, especially down here in the EBID and EP1 watersheds, would be the case between New Mexico and Texas, where Texas sued New Mexico about overuse of the water out of the Rio Grande Conservancy districts all the way down. One of the biggest things that I would look at there is Texas has been very clear from the very beginning. They were negotiating in good faith, and based on information that I've received, it was New Mexico that had some bad actors that weren't properly or weren't negotiating in good faith. And so then Texas ended up suing New Mexico in order to obtain. Now, Texas There's not a whole lot, as I understand it, interest in the actual water that flows down. A lot of it is unusable once it gets down to Texas. But it's the principle of, no, we have to protect our statehood. But from the actor that was negotiating originally, that got it directly from him, Texas is more than happy to come back to the table. Whenever I can resolve a problem outside of litigation, outside of a lawsuit, I want to. Because whenever we are going to a court and we're paying attorneys to defend us, whether it be the Attorney General's office, which it should be, or an outside actor, it doesn't matter. We're spending taxpayer dollars. When you can resolve that without spending those millions of dollars, it is always better for the people. And that resolution can happen. And that's one of the biggest things that I would want to address, to make sure that doesn't drag on for generations and cost us millions of dollars.
Thank you. Mr. Dunn.
So I have two, and the first, and Mr. Hendricks and I have a little bit different take on it, is the water issue. The other is the broken family court system, which I'll come back to in a sec. But when it comes to water, and I was actually part of the EBID adjudication. I've represented clients dealing with the water issue here in this basin, but I also deal with clients that are dealing with water issues on the Pecos River Basin side of things. And we have a little bit different tact between Mr. Hendricks and I as to how we deal with the water situation. I do think that the potential here that water lawyers have seen coming for a while is that we're going to end up owing Texas a lot of money, because there's no way we're going to be able to come up with the water to pay back what they're saying we potentially took that we did not have a right to. Now, the flip side of that is on the Pecos, they're doing the same thing in reverse. And Texas, instead of complaining that we're pumping it out from the bottom of the river here in New Mexico, Texas is now pumping it out from underneath New Mexico on the other side of the Texas-New Mexico border. And they're taking that water and then they're piping it back to New Mexico for fracking. There's none of the regulatory protections in place to protect that water that's actually New Mexico's water under the constitutional principle of equitable apportionment between the states. We need somebody that's willing to stand up to Texas and say, no, 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 you don't get to complain about us stealing your water and then steal ours out from underneath us as well. And that may take, ultimately, a lawsuit between Texas and New Mexico, which as Attorney General I'd be looking to initiate. And I know that litigation is never the most favored outcome, but sometimes when you're dealing with somebody like Texas, that may be the only way that you get their attention and you get them to stop stealing, is to say, no, that's our water. The other is the broken family court system, which I ran out of time and I won't get to.
Thank you.
Okay, we do have time for one additional question, and we'll begin with you, Mr. Dunn, on this. How will you maintain independence from the influence of corporate money in politics?
Well, I have the benefit of not having to worry about getting a whole lot of corporate dollars for my campaign. I will say that I have an example in my life with my grandfather, who's passed, who was a longtime Senate Finance Chairman, and my father, who's the current State Land Commissioner. Both of them have a rule, which is that they won't even accept a meal from a lobbyist. I abide by those same standards. Absolutely, my grandfather and my father made sure that I would understand that that's the standard, is that when it comes to who you serve, what's most important to remember is that you serve New Mexico and you're supposed to work for the best interests of New Mexico. And where that aligns with a corporation's interest, fine. But it cannot be ever put above what is the most important thing, which is to make this state a better place than we found it.
Okay. Mr. Hendricks.
So my response to that is what has already been put in place by like the PRC candidates. Candidates for PRC are not allowed to take money from a company that they would directly influence or directly be in charge of, so to speak, in the PRC. And that helps curtail some of that. I take it a step further. Generally, since we're representing people, I like to bring in money from people. If we're raising money, I would prefer that people donate. It doesn't matter, $5. People show where your heart is, there your treasure will be also. There where your treasure is, there will your heart be. So having a little bit of that treasure, even if it's a small amount, is what I look for. I will also say the way I was raised would not allow for there to be too much undue influence. The reason is I was raised as a missionary kid in a foreign country where we were so poor, the first house we lived in didn't have electricity and water 3 to 4 days a week. It was so poorly made that the sun would shine through the mortar in the morning and wake us up. That didn't tell me get as rich as you can. That taught me that not everything is about money. And that's one of the reasons that I've refused to take money from certain actors in this campaign. is because I don't want anyone to think they have undue influence over me. And that's what my commitment is to make sure that we're researching and knowing who it is that's wanting to give and making sure we make the right decisions of whether or not we can receive money from them.
Okay, Republican Michael Hendricks and Libertarian Blair Dunn, thank you both for joining us for this forum. And thank you to the League of Women Voters of Greater Las Cruces, Kim Sorensen, President. Thank you for collaborating with KRWG again.
And thank you, Fred.
All right, we look forward to seeing you again coming up the week after next. We have the Secretary of State race. And by the way, if you have question ideas, we'd like to hear from you. Feedback@nmsu.edu is our email address. For all of us at KRWG, I'm Fred Martino. Have a great week.